Discovering Atlas, Chapter 5. Kirk looked from the orders in his hands to Admiral Barnett and back several times, suspicion bright in his eyes. This is a joke, right? I don't even have a first officer yet. He shot a meaningful glance at Spock, who was the only other person in the meeting. Hands tucked at the small of his back, expression placid, Spock didn't react to Jim's obvious hint. Commander Spock is here to share his views on the situation, Barnett explained, tapping one finger on his copy of the mission parameters. And no, Captain, it isn't a joke. You're sending me to Eryx Prime. We're sending the Enterprise to the preferred site of the new Vulcan colony, yes. To help the Vulcans talk out their differences with the Eryxians. There are also colonists, and they're mostly based in space stations. But they've been there longer, which is why we have a problem in the first place. And you aren't so much helping with the talks as demonstrating Federation support. You're the flagship, Kirk. So we're just going to fly out there and sit on our hands while the Vulcans argue for their right to colonize a planet that isn't really in use anyway. It's a shakedown mission, Barnett said through gritted teeth, to make sure your ship doesn't fall down around your ears. The new captain frowned darkly, setting his pad down with just a bit too much force. This is a joke! Barnett sighed, covering his face with one hand. Did you have to learn to be so annoying, or were you just born this way? There's nothing we can do? Kirk. The Admiral spread his hands, a silent entreaty for the younger man to accept what he was saying. We need you out there mingling pleasantly with both peoples to show that the Federation is committed to making the situation work for everyone involved. What you can do is be calm and charming and generally positive that Vulcans and Eryxians can share the planet without either group having to sacrifice their basic principles or standard of living. We need you to maintain peace and not get into any trouble. Isn't that enough? Perhaps you would prefer a more important mission, Spock suggested, watching Jim's reaction carefully. His blue eyes went cold as sleet, posture and bearing adjusting in minute degrees to fit this perfect Starfleet standard. On the contrary, Mr. Spock, he replied calmly. At the moment, there could be no mission more important than ensuring the safety and continued well-being of the Vulcan survivors. Exactly as Spock had predicted. Then what prompts your reluctance in this matter, Captain? Jim glanced down at the pad, mouth drawing into a thin, unhappy line. With everything your people have had to suffer, he said quietly, the best we can offer is a thumbs up from the flagship. There aren't orders or treaties or even good old-fashioned supplies we can bring along with us. When he met Barnett's thoughtful gaze, his expression was challenging. The Enterprise should be more than a glorified poster child. I have had diplomatic training, you know, he pointed out reasonably. Like 7 different classes, it almost qualified as a secondary specialization. And the 2 or 3 times I got tricked into hanging out with those weird debate kids, I always managed to. We're well aware of your unprecedented ability to sling bullshit, Barnett assured him with a dry smirk. Jim spread his arms as though emphasizing a final point. So then why not let me fertilize the Congress? I promise I'll try really hard not to piss anyone off. Well, not anybody important. Unless they deserve it, which, come on, sometimes they do. Go to Eryx, Barnett interrupted in firm conclusion. Play nice with the other children, foster understanding and goodwill, and don't get into any trouble. Kirk frowned and opened his mouth. You ship out in 48 hours, the Admiral said. Make good use of that time. Dismissed, Captain. So Kirk sighed, retrieving the pad and shoving it into the satchel he still carried. After a smart salute, he strode from Barnett's office. Spock followed him shortly. When they were under sunlight again, walking together toward the cafeteria and lunch, Jim poked Spock's shoulder demandingly. You knew we'd get this mission, didn't you? Spock considered briefly. I am familiar enough with the situation surrounding Eryx to have surmised the Admiralty would send Starfleet's flagship, he agreed. You might have mentioned, though of course the Vulcan continued without pause, at the time of my reasoning you had not yet been assigned to the Enterprise. Had I attempted to impart my knowledge to anyone outside the Admiralty at that point, I would have been guilty of a criminal offense. Still. Jim donned his closest approximation to the Chekhov pout, holding it until Spock glanced at him. The pout shifted seamlessly into a wide grin when Spock huffed a quiet breath, returned his gaze forward without comment. Strange how even so small a reaction felt like victory. Now that I am officially assigned to the mission, and it isn't a criminal offense any longer, what else can you tell me about the situation on Eryx? My official observations are all unofficially then, Jim prompted, flashing his Vulcan companion a winning smile. When Spock's expression remained stoically skeptical, Jim spread his arms, eyes widening slightly in caricature of childlike innocence. You were a scientist before you became a Starfleet officer, Mr. Spock. Surely you as a scientist noticed something that you as an officer had no logical need to report. Tell me about that. Fascinating, Spock noted. Jim looked at him quizzically, tucking his hands in his pockets. You suggest a dichotomy of thought, a strict division of interests that would prevent me from making a full report. According to your observations, am I similarly lax in all my duties to Starfleet, or does this submission of willfully fraudulent and incomplete reports satisfy me? Instead of backpedaling, in the light of an inferred and unintended insult, as most humans would, Kirk laughed. I wondered if you understood emotions enough to actively attempt to manipulate them in others. That was a good effort, but don't quit your day job. Besides, he added with another grin, shifting the strap of his heavy bag, I never suggested you submitted fraudulent and incomplete anything. That was your own interpretation of my observation of a logical reaction to receiving a great deal of information in a relatively short period of time. Compartmentalizing, he explained. Since you're an intimidatingly thorough scientist, and I've read some of your work, so don't try to fake your way down to amazing or awe-inspiring or something, you doubtlessly gathered far more information than the Admiralty needed or requested in order to make their decision regarding Eryx. Since you're also an intimidatingly succinct officer, I can only conclude you omitted the information the Admiralty might consider superfluous. Yes, big word, I know, we're all very shocked. But what I asked for were the details the Admiralty didn't need, because, as the captain of the starship actually going to Eryx, what is irrelevant to them is very relevant to me. Furthermore, Jim added, shifting gears so swiftly that Spock blinked, it's of note that you are the one who brought us procedural incorrectness and the concept of fraud into the conversation. One might consider that sort of thing telling, don't you think? Spock blinked again. This is why Admiral Barnett hardly ever allows you to complete an argument, he realized. Jim laughed. Are you familiar with chess, Captain? The Vulcan added thoughtfully. I believe you would play a singularly perplexing and ruthless game. See, the chess club thought the same thing, Jim sighed mournfully, which is why they only ever let me visit and never actually join. Apparently one or two games a month was motivating, but more than that, and I started to break psyches or something. He scoffed. Wimps. Spock studied the captain from the corner of his eye for a moment. May I make an inquiry? He asked eventually. Shoot, Jim agreed. When Spock's eyebrows jumped toward his hairline, the human clarified. I mean, go on, ask away, feel free. Indeed. How long have you played chess? Jim shrugged. Years. I don't remember exactly how long. I learned at school when I was pretty little, because what they were teaching was really boring, and just about every other game on the consoles had already been locked to prevent distracted kids from being even more distracted. So it was chess or card games, and I always hated solitaire. Did you continue your study of the game individually? He asked, curious beyond the simple question he allowed himself. Approximately how young were you when you began playing? What were they teaching that you found so disinteresting? What about chess was appealing enough that you would continue your pursuit of it to this day? Was the presentation of yourself as an ordinary sex-driven male of average at best intelligence an accident, or an extension of your aptitude for strategy? Why? Why? I messed around with some other kids, Jim said, responding to the only question Spock had voiced aloud. But it wasn't hard to beat them, so it got too boring to bother after a while. I entered an adult virtual tournament when I was a teenager, though. How did you fare? Jim wrinkled his nose in an offended expression. They banned me from entering the next year because they thought I cheated. It was a total pain. Not that I was even around the next... He cut himself off abruptly, eyes darting from Spock's. But not before Spock saw a flare of alarm at too much information given thoughtlessly. Interesting. You're deceptively easy to talk to, Jim observed, still not looking at Spock, voice light and almost teasing despite the tense set of his shoulders. His knuckles were white where one hand gripped the strap of his bag. I'll have to remember that. You would be the first to think so, Spock admitted. Jim glanced sidelong at him, turning away again almost immediately, but his tension eased fractionally. That minute relaxation resonated with Spock like an accomplishment. Very odd. Hello, James. Jim stiffened, his face blank and hands dropping loosely to his sides as he turned to face a man who approached the new captain with a condescending leer. The newcomer was enormous, taller even than Spock and heavily muscled. Dark eyes and short brown hair were set against an olive complexion in a manner that would have been striking, except for something vaguely threatening in his smile, something menacing in the lines of his body as he came to a halt just inside Kirk's personal space. The smile Jim gave the man was cold and dangerous. "There's no need to be formal, Alfie," he said, tilting his chin slightly to meet the other's eyes without giving so much as an inch of ground. "You can call me Kirk." The man's mouth curled into a snarl. "I told you, it's not Alfie." "Oh, so what is it? Feel free to tell Commander Spock, too, since he's here anyway." Jim spread his arms to indicate the commons where their confrontation was taking place. "And maybe I can flag down some of the other 17 Starfleet personnel hanging out in the general vicinity. Who knows? I'm pretty popular in certain crowds. Maybe everyone within earshot will join the fun. So be sure to speak up, Alfie. Project, you know, from the diaphragm." He kept a hand around one ear. "What was that name again?" "You'll get yours, Kirk," the man hissed, leaning close with his hands clenched into fists. "One day when the Admiralty's fascination with you has finally worn itself out." Spock imposed himself between Jim and the stranger, using one hand to force the bodybuilder to step back. "You are addressing a Starfleet captain," he said neutrally. "You will do so with the proper respect, or I will report you for insubordination." The man barked an ugly laugh. "Oh, sure, right. Captain." He sneered again, pulling a piece of paper from one pocket to shove it violently into Jim's chest. "You're being called again, sir." Jim snatched the paper from him, glancing at it briefly. Eyes and expression cool, he met the stranger's gaze. "Is this a joke, Alfie, from you?" "Don't we all wish?" The other spat. "I have official orders now," the captain smirked, waving the paper in Alfie's face. "I can't just drop everything to dick around with you guys anymore." "You'll report as ordered," Alfie said, eyes cutting over to Spock's in blatant challenge, "or I'll report you for insubordination, Captain." Kirk looked between Alfie and Spock with a blank expression before waving the other human away in a bored motion. "I'll report as ordered by the Admiral," he said with a yawn. "But it'll be on her ass if Starfleet's flagship is delayed because she didn't have enough competent people of her own to fill her quotas." "Whatever," Alfie snarled. He stalked away with fury bunching his shoulders. "Asshole," Jim observed casually. Then he turned to Spock with a crooked, remorseful smile. "Sorry, looks like I have to cut out for now." "That man represents the same group who called you from the reunion dinner," Spock guessed, studying Jim's reaction. the same group that resulted in your back injuries. Jim scowled faintly, glancing away. When he looked back, he just seemed resigned. Yeah, I thought they'd stop asking now I've got an assignment, but I guess not. He sighed, running a hand through his hair. I'd still like to pick your brain later about the Eric's problem. Which wouldn't be hard, he added, eyes bright with a new idea, if you'd just agree to be my first officer. We could discuss it at length on the way there. Have a successful mission, Spock replied dryly, hands locked behind his back. Jim sighed and waved and was gone. The encounter sat poorly with Spock, who began to wonder, for the first time, if the missions that had so concerned Dr. McCoy and Uhura weren't more dangerous than even they had suspected. He hoped the Admiral, whoever she was, would stop requesting Kirk after it became apparent how lengthily and involved the flagship's missions were, and therefore how hard it would be to acquire Jim's particular talents. Somehow it didn't seem likely. Three hours before the USS Enterprise left space dock for her shakedown mission, Spock stepped aboard, personal effects packed neatly in a single duffel at his side. Within 10 minutes, rumors of his presence had suffused every division. Doubtlessly, Jim would arrive while Spock was arranging his quarters, demanding to know why he hadn't been informed of the Vulcan's orders as soon as they went through. The Kirk factor being what it was, Spock wasn't terribly surprised when Jim didn't so much as send a welcome message. In the end, it was up to the first officer to hunt down his captain in order to formally request a place on the ship. His initial stop was to sickbay, where he intended to press McCoy for Jim's location and submit to the mandatory physical at the same time. I had hoped, the doctor huffed in greeting, shooing Spock in with an irritated jerk of one hand, that the rumors were just more wild speculation. Indeed not, Spock said neutrally as McCoy built his baseline charge for the voyage. McCoy grunted but didn't reply. When the scans were complete, he marched into his personal office without glancing at Spock, though he did bark over his shoulder. Come on, and for the love of God, keep it down. I figure I can get at least one more pester-free hour out of this if everyone just shuts up in here. Spock thought perhaps incoherency was not the best way for a chief medical officer to begin his tenure. Then he stepped into the office. As he glanced around in a habitual scan of new territory, his eyes landed on a couch shoved against the far wall, and he understood. Jim Kirk, dressed in captain's gold, was stretched to nearly his full length on that couch, back to the room with his arms wrapped around a cushion that hid his face. He was asleep. Did he sustain any further injuries? Spock inquired softly, never removing his gaze from the steady rise and fall of Jim's back. No, McCoy assured him just as softly. For once he got away clean. But he was so exhausted during his physical that I didn't even have to drug him. I told him to sit while I filed his results, and 5 minutes later he was out cold. When Spock finally glanced at him, McCoy shrugged. He'd already completed his major duties by then. I'll wake him up in enough time for final checks. The doctor hesitated, then sighed. If you make yourself scarce, he said reluctantly, you could probably get away with meeting him on the bridge. I don't know why you and the Admiralty made him sweat it out this long, but it was funny as hell toward the end, and I guess I owe you some help with the punchline. Spock inclined his head, thinking of a human saying about gift horses. I am sure, Doctor, he replied, calculating the likelihood that this man would one day hold Spock's life in his hands and how much improved his odds of survival would be if mutual dislike was not all that existed between them. That you could devise a purpose for being on the bridge for the launch as well. Perhaps you might play to Jim's sentimentality concerning the Enterprise. McCoy rolled his eyes and grumbled, but a tiny smirk played along the corner of his mouth as he glanced at Jim and plotted. Progress. You know, one of you could have told me. The newly graduated senior officers of the Enterprise grinned without looking at each other. paying close attention to their stations while their captain sat in his chair and sulked. "I mean, I'm sure you all knew way before I did, right? So you could have told me and didn't. There's a code violation in there somewhere." He glanced sidelong at the Vulcan standing by the science station. "Any recommendations, First Officer Spock?"
"Yes, Captain."
Spock folded his hands behind his back before facing Jim.
"My best recommendation in this situation would be to brief the bridge on the specifics of the mission on which we find ourselves, including, of course, the exploration of the dossier pertaining to the populace currently dwelling on and around Eryx Prime."
He lifted an eyebrow at Jim.
"That is the matter on which you desired my input, correct, sir?"
Jim heaved a put-upon sigh.
"Yeah, sure."
He sat up in his chair, his expression and demeanor shifting to something more professional. "Lieutenant Uhura, pull up the mission parameters on the main display."
"Yes, sir," she said immediately, retrieving the relevant file. The facts that appeared before them had been part of Chekhov's general announcement upon departure, and were, as Jim had once pointed out, a little vague on details.
"Mr. Spock," the captain informed his bridge crew, "was part of the initial team that established Eryx Prime as the best place for the Vulcan colony. As such, he's had contact with not only the planet, but also the Eryxian colonists who already live there." Jim grinned at his first officer. "Anything you'd like to add to the official report on our way to the site, Mr. Spock?" The Vulcan didn't react to his captain's teasing turn of phrase other than to incline his head slightly.
"Yes, sir."
Long fingers danced over his console briefly as he imposed a secondary file over the information currently occupying the main display. Images of the desert planet's surface were interspersed with schematics of 9 different space stations. "The colonists now known as Eryxians originated on Earth," the science officer began, in a tone that his fellow officers recognized from various lectures he'd given during his tenure at the Academy. "Historical records indicate they left the planet approximately 1 century ago in an effort to form a new society devoted to a branch of study, often referred to as the arts."
"They're artists?" Sulu asked, startled.
He glanced at Chekhov, then Jim.
"Sorry, sir, but you don't tend to get a lot of artists in space. Most of the people I went through Starfleet Academy with were scientists of some nature. The artists I knew thought I was crazy to join and told me so on multiple occasions. It just seems sort of unusual."
Chekhov nodded.
"It was similar in my hometown. Why would they choose to leave Earth?"
"Mr. Spock?" Jim asked, challenging smile lifting one corner of his mouth.
"As I mentioned," Spock continued without addressing any of the comments, "their stated goal was to form a society devoted to the arts. According to propaganda accredited to their organization around the time of their voyage, Terran society had been consumed by the quest for scientific knowledge and technological development to the point of turning its back on the development of the arts, and was therefore irredeemable."
"Harsh," Jim observed.
Chekhov frowned.
"A society that used science and technology to escape the advancement of science and technology?"
"Highly illogical," Spock agreed. "Nevertheless, they acquired official documentation granting them permission to colonize Eryx Prime and left the Earth to have little contact with any outside societies in the years since. To be specific," he added for good measure, "they departed from a region known as France."
Jim startled.
"They're French? As in, like,
French?"
He shook his head, slightly incredulous.
"How French are we talking here, exactly?"
"What I think the captain means," Uhura said with a tiny eye roll, "is do they speak standard, or was their divorce from modern society more complete than that?"
"They have dual language efficiency," Spock assured her.
She nodded thoughtfully.
"So they speak French, too. Did you notice a preference for either language?"
"They displayed comparable ease with both languages."
Spock considered for a moment.
"Though," he admitted, "I did not have an opportunity to interact with any of their children, who would, of course, be the best measure in such instances."
Jim made a thoughtful sound.
"You were there a while to not have met any of their kids." I found it irregular as well, Spock agreed. Inquiries into the anomaly produced no satisfactory explanation, though it was theorized that the children were kept on a separate space station, or else on the planet itself to prevent them from being tainted, or in any way swayed, by the presence of outside forces. Elitists. The captain propped his chin on one hand. Wonderful. It was conjecture on our part, Spock reminded him. It is equally possible that the children were detained with lessons, or else their elders thought to shield them from communicable diseases. Uptight, paranoid elitists. Even better. Do we know why the Eryxians are being difficult about sharing the planet? Uhura asked, filing Spock's trace reactions to Jim's teasing away for later review. Spock shook his head. They have filed no official complaints. How about unofficially? Jim asked. He offered another crooked smile when Spock glanced at him. Historically, the Vulcan said calmly, the Eryxians have been disinterested in, and even opposed, to science and technology. Vulcans, of course, have never attempted to hide their propensity for scientific advancement. The Vulcan Science Academy was highly lauded for their scientists trained there, and it is doubtless that the Academy will be rebuilt as part of any colonization process. It might be speculated that the Eryxians are hesitant to allow what they consider to be their planet to be populated by a people whose study focus could not be more divergent from their own. Science and the arts, Jim mused. Sounds like a match made in heaven to me. Good balance, he added when Spock tweaked an eyebrow at him. Indeed. So what are we supposed to do? Sulu asked, voicing the question shared by most of the crew. When we get to Eryx, how are we supposed to help? Our orders are to support the Congress between the Eryxian leaders and the Vulcan Council representatives in whatever way we can, Spock said. We'll smile and nod, Jim clarified, eyes distant as he studied the pictures of Eryx without really seeing them, his mind occupied with new information. If anyone asks, we're sure all the problems will get sorted out to everyone's benefit. We support completely the idea that Vulcans and Eryxians can coexist in harmony, and in the meantime, we keep our eyes open.
Keep them open for what, Captain?
Chekov asked after an expectant silence. Jim smiled at him, calculations bright in his eyes. For signs about what's really going on, of course. Sulu frowned.
Sir?
Every artist I've ever known has had a respect for life bordering on reverence, he explained with a shrug, leaning back in his chair. It seems unlikely to me that a whole civilization of people devoted to the arts would suddenly decide their property rights to a planet outweigh the surviving Vulcan's basic need for a place to live. Either of these 9 space stations are filled with the biggest dicks in the universe, or something else is going on here. In either case, we're going to find out everything we can about it.
How?
Uhura asked. Our orders specified that we weren't to get into any trouble or cause undue stress to anyone. Kind of a pointed addition to otherwise standard phrasing, sir. Kirk made an elegant, if dismissive, gesture with one hand. Where's your sense of adventure, Lieutenant?
I traded it in for a commission, sir.
Oh, come on, Uhura, don't worry so much. We're just going to be observing. What could possibly go wrong?
They took the children!
Jim froze, hands still extended to shake with the Eryxian's representative. Everyone in the space station's transporter room turned to face the hysterical woman who had just burst through the door.
What? The children!
She ran to the representative, a stately man, with gray streaked through dark hair, and collapsed in a weeping heap at his feet.
They were separated from their study group and stranded on the surface. We sent a shuttle for them, one of the goods transporters, and the pirates took them with the cargo.
The representative paled, swaying with shock. Jim cut his shoulders to steady him, eyes narrowed with furious suspicion.
Pirates?
The representative shut his eyes.
"The Vulcans cannot settle here," he said in defeat, "because we have been preyed upon by thieves and mercenaries since..." "More on that later," the captain snapped. "When did they take the children?"
"Not 10 minutes ago," the woman whimpered.
"Kirk to Scott," Jim called to his communicator.
"Scott here, Captain. Go ahead."
"3 to beam back."
A small, confused pause was followed by, "Aye, sir."
Jim pointed an accusatory finger at the representative as the transportation energy gathered and hummed. "You'd better be ready to explain this when we get back with those kids." As soon as they were aboard the Enterprise, Jim and his away team, Spock and Uhura for their assorted necessary talents and experience, raced to the bridge. Jim began issuing orders before the turbolift closed behind him. "Mr. Chekov, review all scan records. There should be an unregistered ship in the area within the last 20 minutes. Find its entry and exit points. Mr. Sulu, assist Mr. Chekov in setting a pursuit course. We need to follow quietly, since they can't have known we were in the area. I want to preserve our element of surprise as long as possible. As soon as you have a course, set it and go. Lieutenant Uhura, monitor all frequencies for any chatter to, from, or around the pirate vessel. If they have any backup in range, I want to know about it. If they're planning another raid, I want to know about it. If they're gloating about what they intend to do with their captives, I want to know about it. Mr. Spock, assist the lieutenant." For a heartbeat, the bridge crew could only stare at their captain in shock. Jim's expression went hard. "Did I stutter?" he asked in a voice like ice. Activity exploded at every station but one. Spock approached the captain carefully. "If I might have a word, Captain," he requested in a low tone. Jim's stone face barely glanced at him. Spock took it as permission. "Our orders in this mission, sir, are explicit." Blue eyes cut to black, colder than Spock had ever seen them. "What are you suggesting, Mr. Spock?" Jim asked in a low, dangerous voice. "That we allow a ship of dangerous criminals to get away with kidnapping children because we were ordered not to interfere with peace talks?" "Not at all," the Vulcan replied calmly. "However..."
"We have a course, Captain," Chekov called. "They appear to have stopped by one of the neighboring gas giant's inner moons. The planet's field would interfere with many systems in an older ship, including the one we are following. They must think they can hide there without fear of detection, but the Enterprise should continue to function normally."
"Lay in the course," Jim ordered. "Mr. Sulu," he added, "we need to catch that ship. We need to do it now, and we need to do it silently." Sulu answered that challenge as Jim had expected, with a determined set to his shoulders and a stubborn quirk to his mouth. The Enterprise jumped quickly into warp. 20 minutes, sir, and we'll be there. I'll hide us in Mr. Chekov's planetary field."
"Good work, both of you." Jim stood, striding toward the turbolift.
"Lieutenant Uhura, gag all communications on board short of absolute emergencies. Continue to monitor external frequencies."
"Aye, Captain."
Spock calculated the odds of Jim leaving the bridge for anything less than a rescue mission, and stepped directly in his path.
"Captain," he said, firmly but quietly, "Starfleet regulations concerning the pursuit and boarding of a pirate vessel are quite clear. You must report the incident and allow..."
"Starfleet regulations concerning the protection of Federation citizens are also quite clear," Jim snapped in a hushed rejoinder. "We have sworn duty and obligation to retrieve and defend..."
"Trained professionals would have exponentially better odds of..."
"The trained professionals are so overworked lately, we'd be lucky if they got here in a week. And what have we been doing at the Academy all this time, if not training for..."
"Covert operations aboard hostile vessels with no data indicating numbers, or weapon systems, or even species, would be tantamount to a suicide run.
Numbers and weapon systems and species won't matter if we get on and off before they even realize we're there."
"Then what of the reaction? We will be unable to issue formal charges against the pirate crew without documented evidence of their offense, none of which will be permissible if we continue..."
"We'll find some other way to document their crimes, but not by allowing them to..."
"Setting aside even the decision to attempt a rescue without any valid information or support, it would be illogical for the captain of the ship to..."
Bullshit. Being captain has nothing to do with this. I have more experience.
Barring the Nareda mission, your record is utterly devoid of anything that might qualify as experience. You hacked my...
rendering your argument unsound and irrelevant. Look, just because you... I cannot in good conscience allow you to compromise yourself when we could simply use our superior weapon systems to demand their compliance. Putting their hostages at risk, a small chance of violence against the captives hardly defends. I will not let them hurt a child.
Spock froze, chilled by the expression on Jim's face, cold and calm and deadly.
Sulu, Jim called into the ensuing silence. You're with me.
Mr. Spock, you have the con.
When Sulu slipped past Jim into the turbo lift, the captain lifted his eyes to Spock's. Put in the request for backup as soon as we secure the kids. If these pirates are in the habit of preying on a Federation planet, we will make them regret it.
Aye, sir, Spock murmured, stepping away with his hands clenched at the small of his back.
The turbo lift closed. Less than 10 minutes later, they dropped out of warp, hidden from the starship they had hunted from Eryx Prime. Their own systems, meanwhile, were filled with an influx of data, all revolving around the small, outdated vessel. There was no one else within range of the Enterprise's scanners.
I'm monitoring their frequencies, Uhura announced without preamble, putting the two-man away team's vitals on the main display. She patched their communication line to play through the bridge sound system. For a minute, nothing happened. Then,
Kirk to Sulu.
I hear you, Captain.
Good. At least these things work.
You ready to steal shit from pirates?
Without a doubt, sir.
All right, then.
Scotty,
energize.
They were gone.
Discovering Atlas, Chapter 6. Aboard the pirate vessel, the away team materialized in the cargo hold. Score one for Scotty, Jim thought absently. He and Sulu both had their phasers out and set to stun. Mostly, though, Jim hoped they wouldn't have to use them. Confronting pirates wasn't part of the plan yet.
We're going to split up, the captain murmured to Sulu, voice pitched low and soft.
Sulu hesitated only a moment before nodding. You go find the children. As soon as you can, get Scotty to beam them out.
Yes, sir.
The helmsman glanced around the dank, dilapidated, and cluttered hold.
Should I wait for you to beam back or find you to assist?
Kirk slinked over to the nearest doorway, peering around the corner with his phaser held at the ready.
Neither.
Go with the last of the children. I'm going to find the engine room and sabotage it as covertly as possible.
Won't that be a dead giveaway we were here, sir?
Nah.
He used his weapon to motion vaguely at the surrounding architecture. Look around you. This rust heap is held together with duct tape and happy thoughts. There have got to be at least half a dozen major systems failures waiting in the wings. I'll just exploit the hell out of one of those for my own personal gain. No harm in that, right?
Sulu grinned.
When the captain slipped away moments later, his helmsman began the painstaking task of locating an unspecified number of children held in an undisclosed location. It might have taken hours, if not for the singing. Music Sulu didn't recognize drifted faintly from a small side hallway toward the back of the hold. He shut his eyes for a moment, focusing on the gentle, solemn melody. It sounded like a folk song, a complicated harmony carried in a dozen bell-toned voices. Not anything like what pirates might sing. He followed the sound to a set of three small cages, chest-high metal boxes with bars on the front, packing crates for dangerous animals. They were situated along the back wall of a filthy, unkempt supply closet. The sight of those crates, combined with the knowledge of what was in them, filled Sulu with sudden fury. He clicked his phaser to a slightly higher setting, not enough to kill, but enough to communicate a message, and moved silently forward. When he knelt by the cages, all singing stopped. Sulu glanced around, doing a final sweep to assure himself that he was alone with the children, and ducked his head to glance inside.
4 children in each cage, too many for one trip. Scotty would have to beam them out in sets. Not ideal, but also not impossible.
"Hi," Sulu whispered, trying to smile encouragingly.
The children, ranging in age from about 12 all the way down to a tiny toddler girl, shrunk away. Sulu tried not to take it personally.
"My name's Hikaru. I'm the pilot aboard the Federation flagship Enterprise. I'm here to rescue you."
"Hikaru," the oldest child, a blue-eyed little girl, echoed faintly. She hugged the toddler close to her side. "Shine. Glitter. To stand out. Such a bright name. How do we know you aren't another pilot?"
"He isn't dressed like one," the eldest boy around 8 pointed out softly. His accent, like the girl's, carried the soft traces of their French ancestry.
Sulu wondered what Jim would make of that. The boy scooted forward until he was close enough to wrap his hands around the bars. His eyes, when they peered up, were tawny.
"He doesn't speak like them either. Have you really come to save us? We guessed it would take hours longer if anyone came at all."
Sulu began the delicate process of overloading the cage's locking mechanisms. "We arrived at the space station about 10 minutes after you'd been captured. As soon as my captain heard what happened, he ordered a pursuit course."
"How did the pirates not know you're here?"
"They're hiding in a planetary field that blocks all sensors on older model starships. Our ship is new, so they're blind, but we can still see everything." The first lock clicked open. Sulu immediately applied the code to the other 2 units, freeing all the children in moments. He hit his comm unit as the dozen captives stepped free.
"Sulu to Enterprise."
"Scott here. Go ahead, Mr. Sulu."
"I've got all the children with me. 13 to beam aboard."
"Aye, Mr. Sulu. Stand by."
Sulu passed a considering eye over his new flock as it clustered around him, pressing close for comfort.
"I'd also recommend having Dr. McCoy on hand."
"He's already here, pacing about. It's quite distracting, you know."
Transportation energy cut off any response Sulu may have made. McCoy descended upon them the second they materialized, scanning each child with gruff, professional care. This was made more difficult as the children, realizing at last that they were safe, began to cry. Nurse Chapel and her subordinates comforted them as best they could, escorting clusters of weeping children to sick bay, where there were biobeds and food waiting. When he was done with the initial checks, McCoy turned a frown on Sulu.
"Counting you, that's 13. Where's Jim?"
Sulu tried not to fidget. "Well, sir, he's sabotaging the engine room?" The doctor made a furious sound.
"I'll just go check on him," Sulu blurted, turning on his heel.
"They should be monitoring him on the bridge."
He all but ran for the turbo lift and was still not quite fast enough to prevent McCoy from stepping in behind him.
"I'll just come with you, since you seem to have trouble keeping an eye on Jim by yourself."
"Great idea," Sulu sighed resignedly.
On the bridge, all of the usual activity was frozen as the crew watched Jim's life signs on the main screen.
"What have I missed?" Sulu asked Chekhov in a low murmur as he slid into his usual seat.
Chekhov glanced at him with a nervous expression.
"Not much, I'm afraid to say. We know that the Kipton is doing something terrible to their systems, judging by the sounds, but we cannot tell what exactly. Commander Spock has calculated his odds as being very poor for returning without serious injury."
Sulu considered that a moment.
"Better or worse than his odds of surfing in a thunderstorm without serious injury?"
"Oh!" Chekhov blinked, probability ratios bright in his eyes, and then smiled with obvious relief.
"Much better, thank you, Sulu. That is very comforting to me."
"Any time."
Uhura swung around to face them, expression dark.
"Shh," she hissed. "You'll make us miss something."
They shrunk closer to their equipment, heads ducked, muttering apologies. The bridge fell silent again, so tense that the odd snap or bang from Kirk's audio frequency made them jump. Just when Sulu was beginning to think maybe this was a stressful waste of time, Jim made a considering sound.
"Now that's odd," he murmured to himself, unaware that Uhura had hacked his feed and was projecting it across the bridge. After a few more heartbeats of quiet, Jim cursed softly. "Hello," he whispered. "I'm Jim. What's your name?" "Is he making friends with pirates?" McCoy demanded in a whispered shriek. Everyone but Spock hissed at him to be quiet. "Ophelia? That's a pretty name. How old are you?" 13. Oh, hey, that's practically a grown-up." "One of the children got separated," Uhura gasped, a single slender hand flying to her throat. She turned to the science station. "Spock!" He was already reacting. "Spock to Scott. Scott here, go ahead." "Be prepared for another multiple-person transport. The captain will not be returning alone." "Aye, sir. Do you ken how many will be with him?" "At least one more, but ready yourself for more." "Aye, sir." "I'm going to get this door open for you, okay? Stand back a second." The disturbingly loud snap of a high-grade lock being expertly picked rang across the bridge. After a moment of tense silence, Kirk said, "There, that wasn't so bad, huh? It's kind of like an adventure. Scary part's over now, though. The rest should just be fun." A moment's quiet ticked by. "Don't be scared," their captain murmured, gentle and understanding to such a degree that McCoy shifted unhappily, wishing he could prevent the veritable strangers of Jim's command crew from eavesdropping. There was nothing for it, though. A glance around the bridge proved that they were riveted. Chekhov's hero worship looked about ready to manifest a physical form. "Come on, you don't want to stay here with pirates, do you? Pirates suck. My crew's way cooler." "Take my hand. I'll get you someplace safe. My ship's the biggest and baddest in the whole galaxy," he coaxed patiently, never displaying any of the stress that streaked its way through his vital signs. "Now that we know what's going on, we'll protect you, okay? So take my hand and let me get you out of here, because I'm not leaving without you." "Take his hand and go," Sulu chanted to himself. "Take his hand and go." "Come on, Ophelia," Uhura urged, knuckles white where her hands were clamped on the edge of her station. "Good job," Jim crowed suddenly. His unit beeped, signaling an open link to the ship. "Kirk to Enterprise." "Scott here. Go ahead, Captain." 3 to beam back." Everyone but Spock startled. 3? McCoy raced for the turbo lift. When it shut behind him, Uhura traded amazed stares with Sulu and Chekhov. 3, they asked each other. "Upon returning to the bridge," Spock said over their incredulity, "the captain will want accurate status reports concerning the tasks he has assigned prior to departing. All stations will be prepared to issue such reports immediately upon request. Am I understood?" "Yes, sir," all 3 officers chorused, turning immediately back to their tasks. Less than 5 minutes later, Kirk strode onto the bridge, calm and confident, his appearance unchanged but for one thing. Attached to his hand was the 3rd, utterly unexpected member of the final transport. The child's presence forced a collective intake of shock from every member of the bridge, including Spock. It was a young Vulcan boy, calm demeanor belied by the fierce grip he had on Jim's hand. "This is the bridge," Jim told the boy, smiling brightly. "Bridge," he added to his officers. "This is Valtik. He's 12. Today sucks for him because he was on the wrong field trip at the wrong time. His partner in captivity, Ophelia, is with her friends in sickbay. Valtik opted to hang out with us for a while, since this is where all the wild and crazy stuff happens." "Why were they separated?" Sulu asked, staring at the boy with the same level of alarm as just about everyone else. Spock was having trouble organizing his thoughts beyond Vulcan. They took a Vulcan, one of the precious few survivors. That they would dare! "Ophelia is the daughter of what amounts to the king and queen of the Eryxian colonists," Jim explained, still smiling, though now there was a distinct and dangerous edge to it. "I suppose they thought it would be better to keep the VIPs separate from the rest of their cargo." Valtik's value spoke for itself. "Captain," Spock began, tone carefully modulated.
Kirk glanced at him and read the rest of his statement in the deliberately relaxed set of his shoulders. They must pay for this dearly. Yes, Jim mused, more to himself than anyone else. Then he smiled down at Valtic, brilliant and warm, squeezing his hand gently. You want to see stupid pirates get their asses handed them without us ever having to fire a single shot? Valtic's eyes were solemn when they lifted to Jim's, his expression calm. Though he said nothing, he inclined his head in what was almost a nod. Great, Jim chirped. He began stripping off his uniform shirt. Mr. Spock, what's the status of our official backup? Spock sent a map of the immediate area to the main display. It showed the pirate vessel surrounded by 4 Federation ships in addition to the Enterprise. They're standing by for further orders on how to assist with the capture of the mercenary ship and crew. Hold on to this for me, will ya? Jim handed his golden shirt over to Valtic, who clutched it to his chest in lieu of holding the captain's hand. Before they can be captured, Kirk said, as much to Valtic as anyone else, we have to establish that they've done something wrong. We can't use the kids anymore, first because they're here with us, and second because we boarded their vessel without documented and formally established cause. In terms of bureaucracy and what'll hold up in court, we jumped the gun, rendering a whole lot of important shit inadmissible. He glanced at Spock. Correct? Spock nodded almost reluctantly. Sure, he saw a plan building in those blue eyes, but unable to guess what it was. Well, let's see if we can't convince these bastards to do the hard work for us. Sir? The first officer prompted uncertainly. We'll give them some rope, Jim explained to Valtic, something mercenary passing between them in the form of an otherwise pleasant smile, and watch them hang themselves. Quite satisfactory, Valtic murmured into the fabric of Jim's shirt. Uhura, the captain added to the communications officer, could you make an outgoing message from the Enterprise look as though it was being screwed with by the planetary field? Uhura frowned and thought. In what capacity, sir? I want a fuzzy picture, so bad they can't make out details, but clean enough that they can see my face, that I'm human and with the Federation. Distorted, but not destroyed. One small ship is somewhere just inside their scanners, with barely enough power to get a message through. Doable? Yes, sir, Uhura agreed, turning to her station to rig the systems to Jim's specifications. Which ship am I hailing, sir? Jim's grin was wild, more than half pure madness. Why, the pirate vessel, of course. The weak, broken hail that eventually reached the communications terminal of the pirate vessel Moxie was, at first, a surprise. Who could possibly have located them in such a fucking mess of conflicting waves? Evasive maneuvers, the first mate Wallace ordered lazily. Dobson, the only other crew member serving the shift with her, glanced at his instruments with a sour expression. Warp drives on the fritz again. I'll have one of the boys get into it in the morning. Ack! Then main communications lines are down. This shit always happens in bunches. We can't call the captain, or anyone else, for that matter. We'll be running notes by hand until it's fixed. I wouldn't bother anyone, even if we could, not for something as simple as this. They are in their revelry with today's haul. Do we answer it? Dobson asked hesitantly. Wallace punched his arm. Do you think we're all mad here, Dobson? She demanded, shoving him out of the way. Of course we answer. If the captain wakes to find us all in shackles because your frightful ass made our ship seem suspicious in the eyes of the Federation, he'll kill you himself, especially seeing as this is likely a routine scan we can easily outwit. Dobson bowed her into his seat, a sneer on his face. Oh, surely, madam, answer the call. Don't pay any mind to those of us what see tricks and traps in your routine scans. You shut your mouth, Wallace hissed. I'll have you in chains before this shift is out. The console beeped again, and Wallace hit a command to patch the message through. Beyond the static and broken image, Wallace saw a young man. More a boy, really, of reasonably good looks, dressed in what appeared to be the generic blacks of a young Starfleet nobody. Spawn, he was saying in a bored tone. He hid a yawn behind one hand. Hailing unknown vessel. Unknown vessel, please respond. Stupid, he muttered to himself. Coming all the way out here for nothing. Fucking stupid traitor ships. Fuck these fucking demerit hours. Easy win, Wallace thought to herself, putting on her best smoky eyes. Merchant ship Reliant, responding on hailing frequency, she said in a throaty purr. Dobson rolled his eyes. Identify yourself, hailing vessel. The boy straightened from his slump. Two blue eyes, bright with interest at the first sound of Wallace's voice. Well, hello, merchant ship Reliant, he said with a smirk. Fancy meeting you out here. Wallace tittered into her hand, rolling her eyes mentally. Little boys were so easy, it was almost insulting. Identify yourself, she teased. Hailing vessel. He appeared to sulk for a moment, glancing down at what she assumed was fairly standard paperwork. Federation patrolling vessel Fierte, checking this area for ships operating without proper clearance. Please transmit zone authorization codes and cargo list for inspection. Why, Fierte, you naughty boy, Wallace smirked. Are you going to have to board me? Dobson gagged silently in the corner. The boy smirked in return, sending a flutter through Wallace's jaded heart. Only if you don't play nice, Reliant. Your signal isn't very clear, lad. Perhaps you'll have to come over anyway. Ah, if only, he sulked again, ever the petulant Starfleet nobody. I'm sure the captain wouldn't like to wake up and find me gone from my post, though. For now, I'll have to just get your transmission instead. Wallace started the appropriate feat of heavily doctored documentation. Things have a tendency to be a bit corrupt in this region, so I'm not sure how clear they'll be. But here you are anyway. Yeah, the boy mused, studying the files as they arrived at his station. I had noticed that corruption thing. The pirate suppressed her urge to smirk. Boy, you have no idea. Do you have what you need, then? Sure, he agreed, taking a dip toward boredom again as he scanned her information. Can you clarify a few things for me? Stupid paperwork, he muttered to himself. Never the same in any two locations. The extended link to a Federation ship was beginning to make Dobson nervous, but Wallace was used to ignoring him after serving together for so long. Fire away, lad. Necessities is a bit vague. What is it you're transporting exactly? A cruel smirk twisted Wallace's pretty mouth. Livestock. The boy quirked an eyebrow, glancing through the data files again. Huh. That's got to be fun in space. Your ship's pretty old, too. No offense. Where do you keep 'em? The cargo hold. How do you keep them warm down there? She shrugged. There isn't much use to keeping them warm. They'll huddle together if they need to. What about their food and water? Isn't that a drain on your replicators? They don't need much. What's your destination? What's their purpose? Market. Her smirk darkened. They'll go to the highest bidder for whatever use. They're highly versatile animals, after all. So, the boy pulled slightly away from the monitor, drumming the fingers of one hand on his console. You're transporting livestock without proper containment or concern for their basic needs. Your permits don't include trade in animals of any sort, since you're a merchant vessel. Those permits, by the way, expired a decade ago under the name of a ship that was destroyed 5 years before that. Your documentation claims affiliation with a merchant guild that has never sponsored livestock trade. Furthermore, when we contacted them just a moment ago, they made it quite clear to us that you aren't one of theirs. Wallace's heart froze, dropping clear to her toes. Dobson, she cried, wrenching around in her seat. Emergency escape route. I told you, Wallace, the warp drives. Mr. Spock, the boy called calmly, make sure our guests don't go anywhere. It has already been done, Captain, came the distant response. Wallace shut her eyes. Huh, the boy captain mused thoughtfully. And now an escape attempt. They say the innocent don't run, you know. He tilted his golden head to one side, blue eyes cold with calculation. To me, merchant ship Reliant,
he said in a voice soft and deadly as winter. "This all sounds like cause to search your hold." His attention cut sideways to an unseen associate. "What do you think, Lieutenant Uhura?" Their transmission cleared, showing the grand, intimidating bridge of a Constitution-class Starfleet vessel. The boy stood in basic blacks behind a pair of gold-clad officers whose expressions were too angry and dark for such young faces. A woman of exotic beauty sat at the communications station, mouth twisted in a triumphant smirk. Behind her was a Vulcan in the blue of a Starfleet scientist. Worst of all, though, was the small Vulcan boy standing at the captain's elbow, gold shirt held carefully in his arms. Their captive, released. If they had him, the others would be gone, too, along with any bargaining power Wallace might have had. All their efforts wasted, years of planning ruined in a single hour. Who the fuck was this guy? "Aye, sir," Lieutenant Uhura replied firmly. "It should be more than enough to catch this filth. I'll send copies of the transmission to all relevant personnel." "Aw, don't be stingy," the captain teased with a sharp edge to his smile. "We just made a bunch of hardened pirates fuck themselves. Go ahead and send the transmission to everyone. It should be good for a laugh." "You're a boy," Wallace said, the words in accusation. "I'm James Tiberius Kirk," the boy corrected her, "and you're under arrest on suspicion of committing at least a dozen felonies in Federation manned space against a Federation planet and to children of a Federation people. You're fucked, merchant ship Reliant. Go peacefully or one of the four policing vessels hidden around you will blast your kidnapping asses to dust." For a long, silent moment, he and Wallace studied each other. "You shouldn't have taken the children," he said at last. "No," she admitted with a tired smile. "I can see now it was a bad idea. We offer our unconditional surrender. Well played, Captain Kirk." "Die in a fire, pirate scum," he replied cheerfully. The transmission ended. An invasion began. "Do you see why that worked?" Jim asked Baltic, tugging his uniform shirt back over his head. "Not at all," Baltic admitted calmly, extending his hand when the captain was situated. Jim took the hand gamely, nodding to his crew. "I'm taking Baltic down to see Bones now that the worst is over. Mr. Chekhov, set a course for Eric's Prime. Mr. Spock, you have the con." "Yes, sir," the officers chorused. Though Spock's unreadable eyes dropped briefly to the small fingers locked in Jim's before he turned away. "It worked," Jim explained as he and Baltic entered the turbo lift, "because stupid people love to brag. Give them an opening, and they just go on and on, especially if they think they're smarter than you. So what we've learned today is, if you're going to do something big like this, shut your mouth about it afterwards." "Are you promoting willful acts of evil, Captain Kirk?" "Call me Jim," the captain insisted, "and no, of course I'm not. What I'm promoting is the willful suppression of stupid." "If the pirates had not been, as you say, stupid," Baltic pointed out, "they might not have fallen for your ploy." "If those pirates hadn't been stupid," Jim replied, "they wouldn't have taken you guys in the first place." For a moment, Baltic was silent, his fingers tightened on Jim's. "Then you would have had no need to rescue us," he said in a low, soft voice, "and I would not have met you." They stepped out of the turbolift, heading towards sickbay and Bones. "We were coming to Eric's anyway," Jim said. "I would have seen you there, except without all the pirate nonsense and terror." Baltic shook his head. "No, it would not have been permitted." The captain frowned down at the dark, solemn head. "What do you mean by—" He was cut off by the determined swoosh of the sickbay doors opening. "Damn it, Jim, you can't just go running off on pirate ships. Do you have any idea what kind of hideously painful diseases might have been floating around on this cesspool? No? Well, I do. Now I have to update your vaccinations again." Jim winced, surrendering to his fate with such bad grace that the children scattered throughout the room couldn't help but watch and giggle. It all went rather downhill from there. A short while later, Chekhov looked up from his station, blinking when he didn't immediately locate the captain. "Commander," he said instead, waiting for the Vulcan to turn to him, "we will reach Eryx Prime in just under 5 minutes." Spock nodded, clasping his hands behind his back. "Thank you, Ensign. Lieutenant Uhura alerts sickbay of our arrival." "Yes, sir." Uhura called up the communications unit in sickbay, frowning after a moment's observation. "Oh, for God's sake, Shehuff, you've got to be kidding me." "What?" Chekhov asked curiously, twisting in his seat. He sunk down when Spock leveled a raised eyebrow at him, but didn't turn away completely. "It's that ridiculous..." "Here," she said, patching the feed through to the main screen. "I'll show you." In sickbay, Captain Kirk was sitting on the floor, surrounded by children, telling them a story that had their undivided attention. McCoy was frowning in the background, but didn't seem any surlier than usual. Valtik, the only child showing any disinterest in Jim's tale, was tucked against the captain's side, head pillowed on his shoulder, thoroughly asleep. "Is there a problem with him being good with kids?" Uhura rolled her eyes and cued the sound. Kirk's voice filled the bridge, rising and falling with the story, expressive as it ever was. He was speaking flawless French. "Standard, Russian, French," Uhura counted off on her fingers. She looked up, clearly exasperated. "Anyone have anything else to add? Does he secretly speak Swahili as well? Is any of this even in his file?" she asked Spock. The Vulcan's eyebrows lifted. "I do not admit to being privy to the captain's personal file, though I am sure you could ask him." "And find out he joined the French Ballet Corps when his stint with the Russian circus fell through?" She spun back to her station. "No, thank you, sir. I prefer my brains unscrambled." "Indeed. Perhaps now, with your discoveries made, you might inform Captain Kirk that we are nearing our destination." "Yes, sir." Jim nodded when he received her message. "Let me finish up with these guys, then I'll herd them to the transporter room personally. It's been a hell of a day for small people around here." The children giggled at his phrasing, pressing closer. Jim allowed it with a smile, though he was careful to prevent any of them from bumping into Valtik. "Even touch telepaths needed their sleep," he explained, when the children questioned him on it. They giggled again. The toddler climbed boldly into his lap, settling there with pudgy arms wrapped around his neck. She planted a wet, sloppy kiss on his cheek. "On second thought, I might need some help with the herding." McCoy rolled his eyes, walking over to the communications unit. "I'll make sure Jim's new fan club is ready to beam down when we get to the space station." "Even when he's not trying," Uhura sighed with a smile, "he leaves a trail of broken hearts." "I'm not sure about that, Lieutenant," the doctor said, glancing at the bright faces of more than a dozen rescued children. "They don't seem all that broken to me." He closed the link before she could reply.